This is our eighth session with Bob Carr. It's December 21st, 2012. It's Frank Zappa's birthday, and it's also the day that some people say the Mayan calendar ends, December 21st, 2012. So on December 21st, it's December 22nd for Bob Carr. He's in Bombay or Mumbai. We've all forgotten about the terrorism. That was a long time ago. I'm waiting for the next exciting event. So while we wait, we will talk to Bob about the past, which is still the present in some way. Bob, we were talking about you having left Seattle in the last session and moved to San Francisco, and you got involved with the Chemo TV series, TV station, and we pretty well did that in detail. Now we're going to talk about how that led to L.A. and your involvement with Desi Arnaz Jr. But a person who we haven't dealt with too much or gone into is your girlfriend Cindy Shivers, who you meet in Seattle. You did speak about how you met her, but I was interested in how you were able to activate your heterosexual side, since you were mainly homosexual and were homosexual since you were a teenager and hadn't entertained any sexual relations with women. Was that not even in your mind, of the fact that you were now engaged with a woman?
No. I had some experiences in Portland, where I grew up.
In your guru days.
In my 20s. In my guru days, yeah. Right.
Yeah.
There were three, four encounters then. Experiments, you know. It just happened, you know.
Were you bisexual? Was that a term people used?
Yeah, but that was a term people used. I was mainly attracted to men, though. But on some occasions, I was attracted to girls and had some relationship with them, and sexual relationships.
How did that attraction get recorded in your sensibility? How would it register? Was it different from a man or the same thing?
Same thing.
Yeah. Would it be in a spiritual context?
It's purely physical, you know.
No, I mean, it happened in your guru days, and so...
Before the guru days, even, when I was, 22, 3 years old, something like that.
Oh, okay. So...
My first sexual experience was with an older woman I met in a bar, a gay bar. We're sitting at the bar together, and she was very attractive, and we were laughing and talking, and one thing led to the other, and so I invited her over to my studio, and we had sex. I think I told you that. And then afterwards, after it was finished, I went for a walk on the street. I don't know. I felt okay. Now I've had sex with opposite sex, and I really didn't see the difference, too much. Since I was looking at it, sensation is sensation. But I did want to walk around the streets and look around. Feel kind of like I wanted to move on with my life. I never saw her again. But anyway, that was my first experience. And then there were a couple of other girls in Portland, and girls in Seattle, and Canadian girl, and a San Francisco girl. And then eventually, I still was felt more at home with the company of men. The male energy was more was stronger attraction for me. So,
you did talk about that encounter with that the first woman. You did talk about that way back. But the you sort of were you're saying you walked around, had sex with a woman for the first time, and you're saying you were looking. That sort of affected you, that you wanted to move on with your life, or that.
I just felt okay. Now I've done this, and I've done, I've had, and I didn't see the difference. It's just sensation.
Dave Worster says all sex is masturbation.
It is. It's Yuji says it's friction.
Yeah.
All holes are the same. Some are tighter, some are looser.
Yeah.
Anyway, yeah. Anyway, I just I did that. Now it's no big deal, I thought, you know. So.
But when you say you wanted to move on in relation to that experience, or you felt that you had arrived, and now you could move on to what?
Oh, I probably shouldn't have said that, move on. I just felt like that night afterwards, I felt like walking around the streets and just prowling around like an alley cat or something. I don't know, feeling my oats or something. I don't know. Anyway.
Yeah, there are new possibilities. You said, okay, I could have sex with a woman, so there's even more holes I can use.
Yeah, yeah. I don't know. I was 22 or something. Yeah, something
okay.
Like that.
So that's just a preamble to Cindy. So you meet yeah. Cindy. What kind of relationship or world did you guys have she helped you in San Francisco with chemo, right? She went there with you.
Yeah, yeah. I met Cindy in Seattle. We talked about that in the last taping. The thing is, I fell in love. I fell in love. I felt all the, twittery feelings you feel when you fall in love. And I felt good when I saw her and was with her, and we had great sex and et cetera, et cetera. And I seemed to lose an interest in other, looking for sex outside of our relationship.
Mm.
And so anyway,
Did you feel that way? Did you feel that way with Connie in the 50s? Feeling love?
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
Yeah. And Connie and you had become distant around the time you meet Cindy, and he gets involved with another FM DJ.
Yeah.
Okay, so you're with Cindy, and
we all moved to San Francisco because the rock and roll scene is dying in Seattle. It's going through a transformation. From dance hall, venues to large stadiums and big bucks,
Yeah.
The corporate world got involved with running these shows, and so it the light show thing faded out because they were doing a 15,000, 20,000 seat house, and bigger, and so forth. So,
too big for a light show.
Yeah, and that intimate feeling that used to be the hippie feeling was shifting. And it became a very young crowd into a different kind of music, that was coming out.
So, and into Quaaludes.
All the downers started coming, and in San Francisco. When we were at chemo, Cindy and Michael, a good artist friend, Michael Wood, did the graphics at the channel there. But anyway, I was had met Warner Brothers people through their rep, and when they saw what I was doing on video. And the quality of the sound that we were getting, they liked that, and so they offered me a position at Warner Brothers to do their videos for them. I still maintain my separate identity as Retina Circus, but we were like a vendor company. They hired us to do their promotion, and so it started a new kind of. Thing that the record companies hadn't really got involved with too much. They weren't making all these promotional videos. They were making a few. There was a college network that they used to supply video to, and in the commissary areas of the colleges, they had installed video monitors, and they played these tapes. But it was all very very simple and crude. MTV was not born yet, and there was another show that came out of the East Coast that was doing video concerts. And that lasted for about a year or something, and then I think it kind of faded out. And so I danced around with Warner's for 2 or 3 years, and eventually the budgets weren't increasing enough to keep me interested. You know, you do something and you always want to do it better, you know. So also there was a big shift in the management at Warner Brothers, and a lot of the contacts that I had got axed. You know, big major cleanup that was going on in the industry. Payola drugs were behind the cleanup, and Warner's wanted to make themselves cleaner, you know, even though they were you know, behind all this that was going on.
Yeah. Do you remember somebody named Mo Austin, is it?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I worked. Yeah, he was the president of the Warner Brothers when I was working there, yeah.
Did he get moved out?
Eventually, but he stayed during the cleanup period that was going on, yeah.
Did you ever meet Herbie Cohen, Zappa's manager?
Yeah,
At that
I knew well, Herbie Cohen, yeah. Wasn't he from Portland originally?
I'm not sure, but he had an interesting life. In the late 50s, early 60s, yeah. He went to the Congo and ran guns, I don't know, for the rebels or something, but he was very involved with Odetta.
Really?
Who just passed away.
Yeah. I knew Herbie Cohen, yeah. And I only met Zappa when we did a shoot at his studio at his home in L.A. That's the only time I ever met him.
Right.
And I thought he was quite inventive and quite... By the way, that guitar thing that you sent me on YouTube was very sweet, very nice.
Yeah, Watermelon and Easter Hay with the big band behind them.
Yeah, big, very good. Yeah, he was very innovative and very, very inventive character, you know.
Yeah.
So, but anyway, to bring up the Desi Arnaz situation, I was involved with the manager of a rock band in San Francisco. He was working with several, and he was interested in doing a movie. And somehow we met a guy named Hertok, who was a real crazy guy involved with flying saucers and being in contact with extraterrestrials. He was crazy, but it was a means to maybe make a movie, I thought, because movies don't have to be truthful, you know, or as long as it's an interesting story. So he also knew Desi Arnaz because Hertek taught at a college in Hollywood that Arnaz was attending at one time, and they became
You mean James Hertek?
Yeah,
I met him he's a big speaker still in the New Age circuit. I met him about 4 years ago in New York City, spent an afternoon
really?
With him.
Yeah.
He wrote the Book of Enoch around that time.
Right,
something about Enoch.
Right. Yeah.
So
Enoch.
You met him because he was a teacher in the LA area.
Yeah. And he knew Desi Arnaz, and this friend of mine who was a rock band manager somehow heard him or saw him someplace and connected us. Well, I took one, you know, I had a session with him, a couple hour session, and I thought, geez, this guy's really out there, you know. But it's interesting material he has collected, and there's and Desi Arnaz, you know, that rang bells with me. So I said, yeah, why don't we take a meeting with Desi?
Because he was, Hertek was your connection to Desi Arnaz.
Yeah. And this rock and roll manager was Van Morrison's manager at the time. Van Morrison had, you know, rock and roll artists have lots of managers, and this guy was one of many, I think. Anyway, we went to his ranch where he was living this is the manager of Van Morrison, and Arnaz came up, and Hertek was there, And we met in way out in the boondocks in South San Francisco, or actually the Bay Area. And we had a very interesting meeting, and I liked Desi a lot. I thought he was very nice and very, very, very interesting guy. So I made strong connections to connect with him, and we did. And so later on, I went to L.A., and we continued talking, and Desi came up to San Francisco, and he stayed at my house in San Rafael, and it was there that we really honed the idea, well, let's do a movie, you know, that has these spaceships involved in it, because this was before Spielberg's Encounters of a Third Kind came out. But, you know, there were a lot of The Day the Earth Stood Still and all these movies with spaceships and everything was all part of the Hollywood, you know, genre. So anyway, I became friends with Desi, and we kind of went around San Francisco together, East Bay together, went to some rock concerts, and I thought he would be interested in meeting Krishnamurti. And Krishnamurti was going to be talking in Ojai that summer, so we all arranged a group living experience together in Ojai. Desi, Hertak, Connie, Margot, Cindy, myself, we all stayed in Ojai together in a motel, and we were attending the J. Krishnamurti talks. Well, they had a very strong effect on Desi. He kind of shook him up a little bit.
And he's only about 22 years old at this point.
A little more than that.
This is 75, 76 then? 76?
74.
Well, he's born in 53, according to...
75 or 6 it was, yeah.
Yeah, so he's 22, 23.
Yeah. Yeah, he's still, playboy, Desi. So yeah. I used to stay at Desi's house, and I had a room there, and Don Johnson was there, and a lot of actors coming and going. So I was really getting connected to the young sons and daughters of the pros in Hollywood. And so it was just like a second home for me. And so we were, meeting script writers. And here's where Douglas Rostone comes back into play. I told Douglas about the project, and he knew a writer in Hollywood and said that we should meet him. He was the writer that did Fahrenheit, is it 12 or?
451?
Whatever the movie was.
Yeah.
Stephen Geller was his name. And he was a young writer, and we told him about the idea, and he liked it, and he said he would do a synopsis of it. He changed things around quite a bit. And we were talking about getting Orson Welles and, all the Hollywood talk. And we met all directors and film score people. And we got incorporated with Desi's help and his lawyers, who were big-time Hollywood lawyers. They were the lawyers of Frank Sinatra and Desi's mother and father. And they were big players in the field. So I thought, well, this is the way you have to do it. You have to go this route. These are the people that make things happen. Doesn't just talk, but action, So we incorporated and had chairs at the corporation and heard talk. And Beardsley Graham was another man who worked at NASA, got involved. And he was another player in the movie, and he wanted to make movies too. So we had quite a team of people involved here, and it went on and on and on, and meeting after meeting after meeting. We went to Paramount Studios, Universal Studios. We talked and talked and talked and talked, and like what happens in Hollywood, it's mostly talk. Lots of talk. And not much was really happening. Desi was getting a lot of pressure from his mother to do something other than this project, do a television series, do this, do that, make a movie. She was a little skeptical of the flying saucer thing, you know. And anyway...
What was the project? What was the theme of the movie?
Well, it was called Earth Star. And it dealt with the problematic structures of what was happening. Like, we were talking about global warming back then. And going to be one of the big problems in the future. And the spaceships were beings from interdimensional consciousness that came to Earth to warn the people. And the scenario of the movie was to take place on a ship. And there were like Castaneda characters in it, you know. It's a potpourri of everything. We just threw everything in the soup, you know. And
you mean a spaceship or a water ship?
A water ship.
Yeah, it would take place on a ship.
Yeah. Uh-huh. And the captain was Orson Welles. It was really madness, you know.
Well, but, did you have Orson Welles? Was he talking to you?
We had talked to him about doing it, and he was... Everybody's interested, you know, they say that. It's like in Bollywood, they say the same thing. They're interested, but what makes it happen is when you sign them. You actually, you know, sign a contract.
Yeah.
And we had a director who worked for Warner Brothers. Done a lot of films for Warner Brothers. He would direct. I can't remember his name now. But anyway, eventually, I was getting a lot of pressure that was coming from inside of me. I don't know. I was going through a lot of problems with the project. I felt that I was kind of selling out in a way. I thought Hertog was mad. It was really out to lunch.
And yet he had an advisor role on the film.
Yeah. Not. In Hollywood, you have to do all this, you know, to get all the players together to do the thing. And we had dropped the manager of Van Morrison's manager because we felt he was wasn't a strong enough player, and there were other people ready to jump in. This Beardsley Graham was much stronger as a advisor on the project. And after, he was the one that did the video record for Phillips, and he worked for NASA. He was quite a strong in had a lot of credentials.
So that's what do you mean by Phillips? Yeah, what's Phillips?
There was a record. Video record came out before the video tape. It was a digital record that was made, but it never took off.
So, by Phillips, the corporation?
Yeah.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. So, video cassettes came in and took over, and it became the status quo until the digital later.
Right.
DVD and MPEG-3, and so forth.
How many years is this talk period have? Is this only 12 months, or is it 24 months, or 18?
About a year and a half. Here's what happened. Douglas also called me up and said that a friend that he had met in India, a man named Dada, which means brother in India, was visiting him. He arrived by boat. And it's interesting that Dada knew Yuji, and Yuji had given Dada $500 to come to America, and because Dada wanted to explore the possibilities of what was happening in America, and I think he had an itch to be a guru of sorts. So Dada came by way of Yuji. You see how it's all connected? It's really insane.
Who brought Dada to you?
Douglas.
Oh, Douglas.
And said, I have this guy staying in my house, and he's kind of a yogi. He's kind of an ascetic. I met him in Malabalishwar, which is a hill station near Pune and close to Mumbai. And he said he had lived in the forest up there in a small hut, and he has something. He's here, and I want you to meet him. What Douglas was really saying was that, can you take him off my hand, because I don't have the facility to take care of him. He had a wife and two kids. So I met Dada, and I saw the situation, and I had an extra room in my house in Woodacre. So I said, Dada, would you like to visit Woodacre? And when he came there, I could see he would fit in nicely here. So I said, Dada, why don't you stay here in Woodacre, and I'll help you meet some people, and you can talk to Americans and find out where they're at spiritually. And after talking to Dada, I found out that he was very similar line to Krishnamurti. He had met Krishnamurti. He was a theosophist before he went to the jungle to meditate. And he was a yogi, an ascetic. He had been living by himself up in the wilds there and experimenting with meditation and experimenting with what he had learned from listening to Krishnamurti. He knew Yuji, they were friends, and so forth. So something occurred, something happened. He had a mystical experience one night. He was boiling rice, waiting for it to cook, and he said after some time passed, he came back to focus in reality, the world, and saw that the rice had all burnt and the water was gone, evaporated. So some time had passed, and he said he felt different. He felt as if he didn't have a head anymore. So he said that people, when they met him, felt a difference in him. And Indians are very shy about talking about their spiritual experiences. You have to dig it out of them. So he said that something had happened. It was like he took off his hat and he threw it away, and everything went with it. All the thoughts went with it. So something like that. So anyway, I was interested in Dada and helping him, and it was nice having a wise man in your house. But I also sort of detected that Dada wanted to sort of be a guru, you know. He wanted to meet people, and he was collecting a little group of followers, you know. And it really wasn't my thing, you know. I was so into Krishnamurti at the time that the idea of gurus and following was really alien to my way of thinking. And even though Dada was sweet and knowledgeable and helpful in many ways, after six months, I began to feel that it was time for him to move on. And he was sort of turning my house into an ashram. People were coming from L.A. He was visiting in L.A. We arranged a trip to Seattle, Washington, where he met a lot of my ex-devotees when I was in the holy work there. And so he wanted to do a book, and so another friend came up from L.A. and helped him compile some of his information together for the book. And Raj, Raj Mehta, whom I have known now for a long time, who helped me a lot with my book, came to know Dada. He was living near Stanford University and met Dada through some talks that Dada gave there. I was helping Dada connect, you know, with people. Dada was a very interesting man, but he was looking for help, looking for someone to supply him with money to establish himself and write books and present himself, give talks and so forth. But he wasn't a greedy man like some of them, you know. He wasn't really overboard. He kept it to a minimal, because after all, he was talking in the Krishnamurti lingo, and he couldn't, you know, start a foundation and everything, you know. Mm. So he kept it to a small groups of people, kind of like Yuji in a way. Yuji never kept it more than 10 or 12 people, you know, around him at a time. Yuji was very clear about this guru business, and not for a minute did he
did he want create or want to maintain or an image of being a guru, even though people thought of him as a guru, you know.
See,
the word guru means to, it's one who enlightens and lifts the burden in Indian mythology. It's one who points out, doesn't do the work, you have to do the work, but he points out that there's a door and you have to open the door yourself and go through it. So,
okay, I have a couple of questions
living
here.
Living with Dada.
Okay.
And then doing this project, I begin to feel like I couldn't do two things at once. And the call of the spiritual became much stronger. And so I remember talking to Desi and saying, look, Desi, I think this thing, we should call it off. And he said, yeah, funny thing, I've been thinking the same thing. So I went to L.A. and I packed up my things and I said goodbye to Hertok and Bird Beardsley and Desi, and I said, nice knowing you, and, you know, I'll see you again, perhaps. And the only person I saw after that was Beardsley and Desi a few times. I never saw Hertok after that. So I that closed my movie interest in making a movie, and I returned to Woodacre, and at that time Dada had gone on his way, and I was living by myself, and Bob Powers was living there, the boy that eventually committed suicide, that I knew quite well, and I was trying to help Bob. It's an impossible situation. A person who's schizophrenic, chemically, it's a chemical problem, and it's not a psychiatric, emotional problem. It's not a, you know, a mental problem. It's a physiological problem. Insanity is, and you can treat it psychologically, but. I feel now the only way to treat any kind of mental illness is through chemistry and keeping it light around the person. Anyway, Bob committed suicide, and that was a big blow to me. And I was
Are you talking about 78, 79 now?
Yeah, 78.
Right. Let me ask you some questions here. Some
sure.
things have come up. Stephen Geller, according to the Wikipedia, he's most well known for doing the film adaptation of Kurt Vonnegut's novel Slaughterhouse-5.
Yeah, Slaughterhouse-5, right.
Not Fahrenheit 451.
Oh, yeah, I got it mixed up, sorry. Slaughterhouse-5, right.
Right.
Yeah.
And was he your age or younger?
A little younger, yeah.
Right. Now, did Douglas Rostone have something to do with the film project? Was he brought in on that?
Well, Douglas's sister knew Stephen. They went to school together. So that's how the connection was there.
With Stephen Geller.
Yeah.
Right.
And, so we were going to find room for Doug. You know, everybody wants to get in. So you say, yeah, we can fit you in, you know. And Douglas was flirting with Hollywood, too, and you know, there were little side projects going on as well. I was still doing some work for Warner's off and on, and I was doing a Martin Mull project, a television show, which Warner's was going to fund and produce, and I was going to be the online producer on it, and. There were lots of little things were happening, you know, and I was still did some things for some small commercials for the industry, for Columbia Pictures, and I did one with George Carlin, so with the words at Nixon, you know, it was a five dirty words or seven dirty words, whatever.
Seven dirty words, yeah. You did a little video on that.
A little commercial. Yeah, I did an animated commercial for George Carlin. And, you know, we were doing little things there, and we still had the studio in San Francisco that was doing audio and some video production. Not much. Barely keeping alive. Very tough. Tough years. I had to sell a lot of videotape that I had acquired to make sell it for $200 I got to get enough money to live on so I could eat donuts. Luckily, I live with Desi, so I have
no
plenty
rent.
Of food. No
yeah,
rent
no.
And no and no and also a lot of food in the house.
Okay, here's what's a couple of points here. First off, Douglas Rosestone, he knows UG better than you at that
yes.
point, and he's not talking to you about UG.
No.
You don't meet UG till 79. That's when you really connect with UG. Douglas, yes. is he in touch with UG through the 70s before
no.
you?
No. He saw UG a number of years after UG's calamity in 67.
Yeah.
And I told you Douglas didn't think much of it. You know, he got all involved with Doff Region, you know, later, you know.
So yeah, that got him away from UG.
Yeah, well, yeah, right. It gave him hope. Hope.
Right.
Hope that somebody would enlighten him. Yeah.
And did he meet Dada in the United States or over in India?
In India. He met him in Malabashwar, which is a hill station.
Right, I see. But the Dada coming into your life through Douglas, who knew
yeah.
UG, that mm-hmm. was preparing. Dada was a weaker version of UG. You know, you were being drawn into UG in 79 by this reacquaintance
yeah.
with Indian culture.
Yeah.
Through Dada.
I think I mentioned it to you, Bob, that I asked UG one day, I said, what's this happening with this connectedness we have all, you know? And he said, your interest connects you, you know? And there's an interest outside of your interest in doing this.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's like
overall.
Threat.
Yeah.
It's like a meme.
I think, but I'm not thinking. Something else is thinking through me.
That's right. It's a meme, and the meme has a
yeah.
thread, like an email, and
yeah.
and the thread is tightening. It's like the labyrinthian thread. It's bringing people together for its benefit, not you.
Yeah, right.
It's
like the structure, the human genetic structure, is programming all. You know, you to fulfill its program, its desires.
Right, and I see you and I in that meme because I wanted to bring up the next point. In 76, 77, I'm visiting Dave in L.A., and Dave and Paul Seibel are working with, can't remember his name, Dave knows him, and he was working on the movie Billy Jack and another movie about a Vietnam soldier. They were doing the same thing you were doing, trying to get something going in Hollywood in the same years.
Yeah, I think I remember David talking to me about that, you know. So, yeah, it's tough.
Yeah, and so he, and they were tough years for him, tough years for you. You guys were both scraping by in 76, 77 in Los Angeles.
Yeah. I don't know how I did it. You know, I wasn't working. I was doing a little money, and then it's gone, you know. And we're maintaining a studio in San Francisco. And Santana, the band, Santana, Carlos,
yeah.
is a friend. I knew him way back when he was eating dog food. Canned dog food to survive. In Castro District, we lived in the same house. He lived downstairs, and I was staying with Michael Woods upstairs, the artist. And
after chemo.
Right at that time, yeah. Let's see. No, before chemo.
When you just arrived at San Francisco, I guess.
No. I was. We came down.
I came back from India too. See, there was a period I met Carlos. I was connecting with Carlos twice. This was before I met Carlos, when he was, the band had not taken off yet. They were just you know, getting off and do.
Oh, this is film. This is in 67, back from India, when the hippie culture. Yeah. That's when you met him.
Yeah. Then I met Carlos again. Well, yeah, that's when I met him. Pardon me. Right. Yeah. And
then you went to Seattle.
Yeah, and I came back to San Francisco, and then it was chemo then. But during the chemo days, I didn't know Carlos, and the band had taken off, and they were yonder.
Yeah.
And his brother, Jorge Malo, he had a band called Malo. And they
I remember that name. I remember Malo.
They came to the studio and did an hour video with them.
Right. I think you're a little too close to the mic. You're pumping, but keep yourself loud. Just that you were the breath, the wind was coming in.
Okay.
Okay. So let me continue here. So this meme, it's 1976, 77. Dave and them are trying to connect in Hollywood. You're trying to connect. I know you're not talking to Dave in that period very, very little. I mean, I don't know if he knew you were involved with Desi Arnaz and that stuff.
No, I don't think so.
Yeah.